All right, we're going to turn for our Bible reading to Acts chapter 17. Acts chapter 17. We'll read together the first 18 verses. Verses 1 through 18. Now when they had passed through Amphipolis and Apollonia, they came to Thessalonica, where was a synagogue of the Jews. And Paul, as his manner was, went in unto them, and three Sabbath days reasoned with them out of the Scriptures, opening and alleging that Christ must needs have suffered, and risen again from the dead, and that this Jesus, whom I preach unto you, is Christ. And some of them believed, and consorted with Paul and Silas, and of the devout Greeks a great multitude, and of the chief women not a few. But the Jews, which believed not, moved with envy, took unto them certain lewd fellows of the baser sort, and gathered a company, and set all the city on an uproar, and assaulted the house of Jason, and sought to bring them out to the people. And when they found them not, they drew Jason and certain brethren unto the rulers of the city, crying, "These that have turned the world upside down are come hither also, whom Jason hath received. And these all do contrary to the decrees of Caesar, saying that there is another king, one Jesus." And they troubled the people and the rulers of the city when they heard these things. And when they had taken security of Jason and of the other, they let them go. And the brethren immediately sent away Paul and Silas by night unto Berea, who having coming thither, went into the synagogue of the Jews. These were more noble than those in Thessalonica, in that they received the word with all readiness of mind, and searched the Scriptures daily, whether those things were so. Therefore many of them believed, also of honorable women, which were Greeks, and of men not a few. But when the Jews of Thessalonica had knowledge that the word of God was preached of Paul at Berea, they came thither also, and stirred up the people. And then immediately the brethren sent away Paul to go, as it were, to the sea. But Silas and Timotheus abode there still. And they that conducted Paul brought him unto Athens, and receiving a commandment unto Silas and Timotheus for to come to him with all speed, they departed. Now while Paul waited for them at Athens, his spirit was stirred in him when he saw the city wholly given to idolatry. Therefore disputed he in the synagogue with the Jews and with the devout persons, and in the market daily with them that met with him. Then certain philosophers and of the Epicureans and of the Stoics encountered him. And some said, "What will this babbler say?" Others, some, "He seemeth to be a setter forth of strange gods, because he preached unto them Jesus and the resurrection." Amen. We'll end our reading just there. And we'll be coming back to this, of course, in our message this evening. Acts 17. As you read these missionary stories and ventures of the Apostle Paul, and as he goes from city to city, he moved into Europe. The first place was Philippi, then Thessalonica, then Berea, and then he enters Athens. And you could say it's more of the same. Well, when you're on to a good thing and it's working for you, don't change it. When the chickens are laying their eggs and the cows are producing their milk, don't change the routine. Make sure you keep on what you're doing. And Paul found that the method he was using of going into a new city, finding a synagogue, going there to speak, as opportunity allowed, the message of the gospel, persuading men that Jesus was the Christ, and that some would believe, others would doubt, and then, of course, he would be driven out because of hostility, and he would go on to the next place to minister the word. But when he got to the city of Athens, and he was literally driven there because of the hostility that was behind him in Berea, Timothy and Silas, they remained and drove Paul on to the safety of the city of Athens, which on the map, by the way, is pretty much the southern tip of Greece, right in the Mediterranean. And it's known as the area of Attica. And it is the heart of the education world, the city of Athens. And when he arrived there, he was in a waiting mode. If you look at verse 16, now while Paul waited for them at Athens, he went on for his own safety, and he was remaining there for a time while the others were catching up. That would have been Timothy and Silas. And while he was waiting there, it could have been a relaxing time. He could have been taking in the sights of the city. Paul, being a very well-educated man, it would be very much like an academic from some of our Canadian universities going to Oxford for the first time. And it would have had certain appeal, just the notoriety of the place, to know that great teachers like Socrates taught here, and to know that various people stood on certain spots and delivered their great speeches and orations. Paul could have used the time to be a mere tourist. But he noticed as he went around the city that it was covered with idols, with various forms of heathen gods. He must have been bitterly disappointed that the place which was the center of the world's education was the place of the greatest superstition that Paul had yet to meet. And you would wonder how these two things could go hand in hand. The place of philosophers and the place of superstition. But just think about our major universities in the Western world. The places that advance in academia are the places that have least time for the knowledge of God and are the surest to receive the notions of superstition and even false religion. It was said of by a satirist prior to the time of Paul, and he was on record in saying that in Athens it was easier to find a god than a man. The place was coming down with idols, statues, images that decorated every building and every square, every open space. You just couldn't get away from this. Now you'll find in that verse 16 that we already referred to, that while Paul waited for the other men at Athens, his spirit was stirred in him when he saw the city wholly given to idolatry. His spirit was stirred within him. And as I read that, I got to thinking about the things that upset a Christian. The things that can make you either very sad or very mad. This emotion that filled Paul's heart, as he observed, he was but a visitor. He was waiting for these other men to join him. He had no intention at this point of entering into any plan of ministry. But as he looked around and walked around and observed these things, a passion filled his heart. I wonder, do we have this passion as professing Christians? Is there to some degree this same emotion, a stirring as it's recorded here, in our hearts when we look around our city and we see the marks of ungodliness, the things that upset us? Now, I want to launch off into this direction tonight, and I'm not really going to deal any more with Athens and Paul's visit there and all those events. I'm going to deal with this issue. The things that upset a born-again Christian. A man or woman of God who have something of the stamp of God as Paul had. And when you walk around and look at your city, they grieve you. They stir you into a passion. What might they be? Well, there's one sure thing as you drive around or as you go around our city that upsets the Christian today. It's the proliferation of gambling in our society. No matter where you go in our city, every municipality seems to want to have a major casino. We have one about 2 miles to the east of us here in Langley. We have one about a mile to the west of us here in Cloverdale. Major million-dollar complexes. Very recent constructions. Because it's only recently that these municipalities have been permitted to enter into the casino business. And it's the same in Richmond, it's the same in Vancouver, it's the same in Coquitlam, and perhaps other municipalities as well. When I was up in Prince George recently, driving up Highway 97, entering into the city, to the left is another huge casino. It just stands out as a great elephant building in the very modest buildings of the city. When you drive down I-5 and you're going to Seattle, you're in the Everett area, there is a massive, massive parking lot with a castle-like building, and there's a Home Depot nearby, and it totally dwarfs Home Depot. I can't imagine how many parking spots there are for that casino. And if that is anything like the local casinos that I observe here, the parking lots are usually filled, even on weekdays. It just boggles my mind. Where do the people come from? Where do people get the time? And where do people get the money? And it's all a business for the rich to get richer and the poor end up becoming poorer. Back in Proverbs 22 and verse 16, we read these words. He that oppresseth the poor to increase his riches, and he that giveth to the rich shall come to want. So any politician or any businessman that enters into the casino business, and it is a business, this is not pure entertainment. This is the big dollar factor of municipal life today. Municipalities believe that they can earn large tax dollars to pay off their various schemes in their municipality. by casinos. Also, we have hospitals that are being, to a fair degree, funded by lottery schemes. And they're being advertised all the time. We're being bombarded with a lottery ticket as a purchase to support the hospital as much as to win the various prizes. And so these are great schemes, but it's oppressing the poor to increase riches. Now, I preached on this some time ago, and I looked up the notes and the sermon I had on that, and I want to give you tonight my seven reasons why I am against gambling. Now, those who have a very good memory will remember these 7 points, right? If you remember all 7 points, you'll certainly be credited with a very good memory. So I'll give you these points. I am against gambling because it is against the 10th commandment, thou shalt not covet. And of course, this is the whole tendency of get rich quick. This is not honest money. This is the desire to be rich. Someone asked John D. Rockefeller, how much money does it take to satisfy a man? His answer was, just a little bit more. A little bit more. And if you get into his lifestyle, it's just another million or two more. You're never satisfied. Also, gambling. I'm against gambling, for it's against the royal commandment. And that is to honor the Lord and to honor your neighbor as yourself. Gambling is not neighborly. It is never do unto your neighbor as you would have him do unto you. It is to destroy the other that you may take all. Thirdly, I'm against gambling for it's against Christian contentment. The Bible tells us that godliness with contentment is great gain. And better is a little with righteousness than great revenues without right. And the gambler is probably the most discontent man, woman, or young person of all. I say young person because I looked up some of the problems of present-day gambling, and there are children as young as 10 years of age becoming hooked on gambling. Teenagers at school that become dysfunctional in their schoolwork and their career. They've got a taste of winning money, not necessarily in the casino, but some form of gambling. And thereby, they are opting out of the normal pursuits of life. And this is becoming a great problem. It's against a life of usefulness. It's a prodigal life. I'm against gambling, for it's against a life of faith. How can you be trusting the Lord when you're buying the lottery ticket or going to the casino to buy the chips to hopefully win on the bets? Whereas some people trust in the one-armed bandit and all the money that they can put into that. But the Christian trusts the Lord with his finances. And as you put your tithe into the offering basket in God's work, you do believe by faith that God will honor as you honor him. Number six, I'm against gambling, for it's against a life of grace, of trusting a good God. The gambler takes the attitude, I'm out for myself because no one else is. But a life of grace believes in a good God who orders our footsteps and who blesses us beyond even what we deserve. And lastly, I'm against gambling, for it's against saving men's souls. Gambling and evangelism don't go together. They're opposites. Money becomes a man's god, and his ego only destroys his soul. Riches make themselves wings. And as Paul went around the city of Athens and saw these various false gods, he was stirred. I, as a Christian, am stirred at the gambling casinos in our city today. It's going to ruin untold numbers of people and change our society to that which is lusting after money and destroying people's souls. Another thing that should stir up a Christian, as we look around our city and see the trends that are developing, the second thing that would stir up the believer's heart is the proliferation of heathen temples. We see one massive building after another. These are edifices for the worship of false deities. Now we have buildings that were once built for the preaching of the gospel and they have become apostate, and where the Bible is no longer honored, and that certainly grieves us. That is a great grief to the Christian. And especially if your family was in the community long enough that their father or grandfather had a part in building that church and seeing it established, and then a new generation rises up to preach another gospel, that's grievous. But there's something even further in Vancouver today, and even here in Surrey, and that is non-Christian religions abounding, building their elaborate temples to honor their gods, their heathen gods. The zeal that is behind it is admirable. The desire they have to pursue their religion is something that we would have to say puts us to shame, perhaps. The expense, the architecture, which put many Protestant buildings way down the ladder. But it is zeal without knowledge, nevertheless. And it's an attempt to honor deities and gods that are not true. Another trend we have in this country are donations to various institutions to promote false religions. Harvard has just received its second largest donation ever to establish a new department for Muslim Christian studies, supported by a donor from Kuwait. I believe the figure was $27 billion. And the students, those who enroll or those who take an interest in it, or all students perhaps, will have some exposure to the influence of Islamic Muslim studies at Harvard University that was built by Christians. And here in UBC, on a smaller scale, $4 million was donated to commence a department of Buddhist studies just a month ago. And at BCIT, there was a decision made to introduce Asian cultural studies to help businessmen in business studies deal with Asian business techniques. Now that's less direct, it's more indirect, and perhaps it is in relation to the new trends and the growing trade relation there is between this country and Asia. But nevertheless, we see these influences coming upon this land, and the Christian value is being set aside. Now, if you look at verse 18 in Acts 17, you'll find that when Paul, being stirred in his heart, and he began to speak about these things, you'll notice in verse 18 that the philosophers encountered him. And some said, "What will this babbler say?" You'll notice there was ridicule. The word babbler in the original language means seed picker. It means a nobody, a man of no learning. He's only picking up a few thoughts and a few ideas here and there. He knows nothing. He's a babbler. And so they despise him. And that's the trend we see in many institutions and many organizations today. Christian values despised. That ought to stir us up. That ought to awaken us and realize it's time that God visited this nation in grace and in power. A third thing, as I look around our city, that would stir up the heart of a Christian is the godless education system, especially here in British Columbia. In this age, more and more emphasis is placed upon education. Almost all young people are expected to certainly go through kindergarten through grade 12. And a big majority of young people are expected to go on to university. The pressure is on educate, educate, educate. The pressure is on parents. The pressure is on young people. The pressure is that if you don't attain these levels of education, you won't have much of a career. And with that pressure in this province in particular, it is a godless education that is offered in this society. The BC Teachers Federation is the epitome of a brand of anti-Christianity that prevents any effort to teach the values of Christianity. That has been their goal for a number of years, and they have succeeded in banishing any effort in the classroom, any remnant of Christianity. I want to tell you about a lady that actually used to attend this church. She was a teacher in a public school, in an elementary school. She's now in glory. She's with the Lord, so I can tell you about her freely. I remember talking with her, and she would tell me of the years of her educating children, teaching children, and when she was in elementary classes, she would start the day with Bible stories. She was a public school teacher, and she would start the day with Bible stories. And this would make a big impression upon the children in the class. They would settle down. There would be an atmosphere I'll call it morality. There was an understanding. Here is a woman that stands for something. And many of those children went home and told their parents the Bible stories that they were hearing. And some of those parents came to her with difficulties they were having with children in the home. And they greatly respected her. But as the years went on, it became more and more difficult for her to have those Bible stories in the class, and she had to scale it back and become very careful in what she said in the classroom. She never gave up, by the way, until the day she retired. She never gave up, but it became very difficult for her. Today, in British Columbia, I would be surprised if there are any public teachers who have the liberty to read directly out of the Bible or Bible stories, not even at lunch hour, not even with a permission slip from parents to do so during lunch hour. Now, I do know that in Fredericton, the Reverend Tony DiDurno, he and his wife and a couple of other helpers go into a public school there. I'm not sure if it's lunchtime or after school. I think it's lunchtime. And they get permission from parents. They sign up parents to allow their children to attend their Bible club. And it's in between class period. They don't do it during class period. But in between somewhere, they have these kids come. And they're getting 70, 80 children to their Bible club right on the premises of the public school during the school day somewhere. I'm not exactly sure of the time. You couldn't do that in British Columbia. There would be a protest because there's an agenda to get the Bible out of the public school. This ought to move our hearts. And in some ways, we as Christians have given up the battle and said, well, that battle was lost 10 years ago, and we're never going to get it back. When I was 11 years old, I went to high school from the elementary school. The Gideons presented to everybody moving into that first year in high school a New Testament and Psalms Bible. New Testament and Psalms. I remember reading that from time to time. Now, I must confess that those years there wasn't much Bible reading in our home. It was a very rare thing. But I can remember reading that little New Testament. And I remember, to my surprise, my dad, he could quote Psalm 1 because he learned it in Sunday school as a boy. Now, we didn't read the Bible on a regular basis in our home. But in those days, Bible reading in school was a normal thing. Today, we have a generation of young people that are growing up. They don't know the Bible, nor the God of the Bible. This ought to stir our hearts as it stirred Paul's heart when he went into the city of Athens and he witnessed these things. We need to be moved by these things rather than just surrender and say, well, that's the way it is here and what can we do about it? When you look at verse 17, you'll notice what Paul did do about it. And I'm really going to preach about this next time. But let's just take a look briefly at what he did do about it. Therefore, you'll notice now he has a purpose. Therefore, because he was so moved, he was so grieved in his heart, he was so disturbed by what he witnessed in the city of Athens, disputed he in the synagogue with the Jews and with the devout persons and in the market daily with them that met with him. Now the word disputed, in the Greek word, it is really dialogued. It's not that he went in with a negative, nasty attitude and argued and debated in a negative way. He dialogued. Paul had a winning spirit. In fact, I'm reading a book on this about Paul at Athens, how he had the ability to debate with the Athenians and use the Socratic line of oratory and debate, because he knew it. He was educated in that style himself. And so Paul didn't go in there as a nasty person disputing. He was dialoguing. And this was his way of countering the superstition that was all around him. It was one-to-one in the synagogue, in the market, with the devout persons. Comes right down to personal work. And we need to do more of it. We need to have the gift of God to dialogue with men the message of the gospel. The great need of this church, and any church that's going to grow with the message of the gospel, is that every person in the church goes out dialoguing with men the message of the gospel. Friends, neighbors, or deliberately selecting an area and says, there's 100 houses, I'm going to make that my mission. I'm going to take them literature, I'm going to knock their doors, I'm going to ask them for prayer requests, I'm going to do anything it takes to make my face known in that area, and I'm going to give them the gospel, I'm going to go back again, and by God's grace, by prayer, I'm going to seek to be a witness. Now, that's the hard way. But you'll notice here from this example of Paul, it is the biblical way. And there's many of us that shy away from it. There's many of us that say, well, let's just hang the church sign up. Let's do something with mass media. Let's do something with blanketing the area with literature. Get on radio, do all those things, and wait for the people to come. That's not what Paul did. He dialogued in the synagogue, in the marketplace, not only with common people, but with the devout people. And then you'll find later in this chapter that he also went to Mars Hill, which was the place where the judges sat, and they listened to his message, and he preached Christ and the resurrection. Here is the lesson for us tonight. First of all, we need to be stirred in our hearts. If you think tonight that Vancouver is all right the way it is, if you think that men are living and dying the way they are, it's okay, well then, we don't need the gospel. But if we are moved with the superstition, the darkness that's around us, and that somebody needs to do something, then it's us that we need to start praying about, and that God may use us to reach men with the gospel. We need to pray for the skill to do it. We need to pray for the wisdom to do it. We need to pray for the opportunities to open. We need to pray that God may use us. It's going to take a real ministry of prayer on its own. I trust tonight that you can look around this city and be like Paul and say, I'm stirred to the point where I must do something to spread the gospel.